done for the border at the end of this month here. The three major averages still in the red for March. The Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ all lower, anywhere from 6% to 8% to the downside, again, for the month.
The major indices are on pace for their worst month in more than 2 years.
As we wrap up a largely dispiriting quarter, is that if you can't handle the news flow, both fake and real, you need to use this rally to lighten up.
Earlier in the week, we did see some actual real news around Facebook, Tesla, NVIDIA even, and Uber. And so we're not surprised when we see real news potentially dragging down stock prices.
Almost everyone was crying, throwing up the flag of surrender, even as President Trump talked about trade and tariffs and pushing back on China trade.
Meanwhile, Russia conducting its second test of a new intercontinental ballistic missile. This is Russia also expelling scores of diplomats.
What happens next week, though, could be very interesting.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it was a mixed week for the markets this week, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average, transports and utility only indexes in positive territory. NASDAQ took it on the chin, along with the S&P, as worries continue and investors continue to fret over various worries from trade wars to possible rate hikes coming from the Federal Reserve. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's shortened edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Robin Griffith will be joining me. And despite all this volatility, he says, you know what? It still looks pretty good for the market. There's no danger of a death cross of the 50-day moving average crossing over the 200, as some people have been speculating on. He said, right now, there's just too many good things going on with the economy to keep us out of bear market territory. He's seeing a rotation into beaten-up stocks like GE and IBM, some of the big blue chips in the average. And he also says he still owns some gold, but he's not really positive on it. You want to hear why. And speaking of gold, Dave Morgan will be joining me here from the Morgan Report. He said silver has got the best setup in terms of what's going on with the Commitment of Traders report, but also he says that the markets are negatively correlated. In other words, metals negatively correlated to the markets. You're going to want to hear why and what his views are on precious metals. That and Ryan Poplava talking about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, this month, it's 10 years that a financial crisis engulfed the U.S. and global financial system, almost bringing it to the brink of collapse. And it took Herculean efforts by the Fed and central banks to pull it back from the precipice. And this required trillions of dollars to hold it together and to reflate financial assets and restart economies. Now, today, the markets are at near record levels and the economies seem to be puttering along in synchronized growth. So what are the warnings of another such crisis on the horizon? Is that a realistic prediction? And if so, what then should we do? That's the subject of conversation today coming up on The Big Picture. And we'll have Chris Sheridan doing a special interview on the problems that are coming to the forefront now of technology, and that of course involves technocracy as well as artificial intelligence. All of that today on the Financial Sense News Hour. And welcome back, Ryan Poplava, to review the drivers and catalysts moving the financial markets. It looks like we did have another bumpy ride on Wall Street for the stocks this week. So, well, what do you make of things? I mean, are we still reeling from the fears of a trade war with our trading partners, or have we moved on to some other angst?
Well, John, whenever you get volatility, certainties extracted from the markets and you get fear. That's why they call the VIX or volatility index the fear index. So, you know, with all the uncertainty we've had, there's been a lot of cross currents lately, right? There's been potential trade wars. There's been tariffs. There's been really well-known stocks that are probably in many portfolios, like the FANG stocks, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Alphabet, Amazon. You got a lot of these stocks. Some of them were under attack last week. Facebook, with its technical issues with the information released, that Facebook's Cambridge Analytical scandal, that's kind of started things. These stocks were very high priced, very big PE multiples. A lot of them have had parabolic moves. I was looking at Amazon, Netflix last week, looking at between 30 and 40% downside risk if they were to test their 200-day average. So we had quite a bit of that this week. So quite a bit of the technology stocks, well-known names, were under pressure. So that has led to what you mentioned was just definitely a bumpy ride. So where we left off last week and tying into where things got started this week was the $60 billion tariff announcement by Trump, which was the first shot, first salvo at China tackling the trade deficit there between our two countries. And China, of course, fired back, talked about a $3 billion in tariffs on a number of unimportant trade things. So it was definitely they were leaving a lot of powder dry with this first attempt. But they don't want to appear weak. Of course, nobody does. So that's where things started. That's where we ended last week. It was a nice downtick on Thursday and Friday. Now, heading into the weekend, the Wall Street Journal had an article that they wrote, appeared on Sunday, that essentially said U.S. and China have started constructive negotiations to reduce Chinese tariffs on U.S. automobiles, more Chinese purchases of U.S. semiconductors, and greater access to China's financial sector by American companies. So that kicked things off. The market opened up higher on Monday morning. And if you read further, it definitely shows that lines of communication are clearly open between the Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Trade Rep Robert Lighthizer and China's top economic advisor. That's Liu He. So with that news, we saw big risk move on Monday. We saw technology leading. Financials were doing well. But volatility did continue. In fact, that rally did fade. At one point, the S&P was only up 0.5% on Monday, even though we did finish up 1.8%. So we definitely saw bulls come in and drive prices higher. Many wondered if that we were looking at the bottom. As I mentioned last week, I would have been very comfortable if we dropped below the 200-day average very briefly and then rallied back above it. And that didn't necessarily happen this week. We kind of traded all along kind of the floor all throughout the week. However, we did see some selling. It did get faded on Tuesday. A lot of up and down, like you said, it was a very bumpy ride. And that was due to a lot of the tech stocks, a lot of the financial stocks in the middle of the week were weak.
Yeah, and the rest of the week really did seem to continue the volatility story. It was really an up and down week. Now, what would you say is some of the cause of the volatility post the comments that started the rally on trade negotiations?
We talked about how some of last week's weakness wasn't helped by the loss of leadership in technology. As I mentioned, the Facebook's Cambridge Analytical scandal kind of started things off two Mondays ago. The company's still reeling from that. It broke down some key technical support levels, created a top. Some are starting to say it looks like a bargain here. So there may be some buying that's coming in and they're trying to do some damage control, of course. But like I said, there was more weakness that was spread out through some of the other big names. So again, the notorious FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Alphabet, and some would say you could add Apple in there too, maybe also add in Nvidia, which is a Wall Street darling, and you still got FANG. But essentially looking at what happened about midweek, there was a Axios report that Trump would charge Amazon and maybe possibly change how Amazon's tax treatment is currently, saying that the company has had a free ride from paying its fair share. Now, the White House immediately deflected comments, saying that there's nothing official, but they're always looking at options. However, on Thursday, Trump made some side comments about Amazon and said that these comments may add some credence that they really are looking at the company, that the company is under scrutiny. And so that didn't help because, as I mentioned, Amazon is a high-priced stock. It has had a very nice move to the upside with definitely some downside risk if it breaks through some of these key support levels like its 50-day moving average. And that's also the case for, I believe, like Netflix looks exactly the same. Also, as I mentioned, Nvidia as a Wall Street darling for the past year, that dropped quite a bit when they announced that they were suspending autonomous driving tests due to last week's fatal crash. So that didn't help either. So leadership, something, you know, the market had looked at in the last correction going into the February low, what led us out of it? It was tech. In fact, the NASDAQ hit new all-time highs over that next rally while everything else maybe didn't. Small cap did come up towards its highs, but nobody else was able to reach those highs. So that lack of leadership and not finding that in financials, that continues to weigh on this market. So leadership was hit hard. Couple that with the other large sector financials, which you saw the yield curve flatten to the lowest it's been since 2007, John, with the spread between 2-year treasuries and 10-year treasuries right now at about 49 basis points. That's narrowed. And like I said, you just get another very important sector communicating that risk is off.
You know, it certainly appears like the market had a resounding answer on that note, with the S&P 500 up 1.4% on Thursday, and that had us ending the week on a positive note. And it seems that all of the risk on members were there for the show, with tech performing the best, and then reflationary areas like steel and energy outperforming at the industry level. So it really was a bumpy ride this week. What were the drivers that led to such a reversal?
Well, the rally on Thursday, John, was definitely a high quality rally. If I was to look at how the advances went this week, you look at Monday's push higher, you look at Thursday's push higher, very high quality. You had a lot of advancing issues. That to me is a very clear sign that we definitely did have some accumulation this week in stocks. And rightly so, we've retested that 200-day average. We didn't break it. This makes sense to go in at a significant support level and begin adding some exposure. But Thursday was a bit of a puzzlement to me, John, with if you look at treasuries, they were rallying all week, and even into Thursday with the rally in stocks, we saw also a rally in treasuries all across the curve. They look at from the short term to the long term, yields were down while, like I mentioned, those risk on areas, reflationary areas, cyclical and metals, energy, they were leading the stock market higher on Thursday. Looking at what did we get on Thursday? What kind of economic data that might have created that situation? It was the PCE inflationary data. And that's the favored inflationary indicator for the Fed. It was announced barely ticking higher, up about 0.02% for both core and non-core readings in February. Year over year, the readings showed that inflation was up 1.6%, just a hair higher than where we saw things in January. I didn't see that as a big inflationary tell, but like I said, reflationary stocks, that's what was leading the market higher. So maybe they're reading something into it that maybe I didn't see. So it's not typical when you see this kind of action, looking at all how 2008 has been trading, it's been the reflation trade. It's been yields climbing, treasuries falling, and stocks rising. And which stocks? Reflationary ones. It was metals. It was energy and also technology and anything that was pro-cyclical, industrials as well. But the rally in treasuries that started earlier in the week, and we saw that also, it was kind of accentuated by the 7-year auction. And if you look at the 7-year auction, it was pretty solid. And we didn't see any of that action fade into Thursday's trading. It may be that both treasuries and this risk-off trade are acting according to their own technicals right now. You look at the yields on the 10-year treasury. They've fallen below a key short-term level that was around 2.8%. Remember, we were pushing 3 almost. So dropping below 2.8%, we're now below the 50-day moving average on that yield. It's likely that this is going to continue as we kind of test maybe the 2.6 level. That was a very key level that we broke out above, never retested it. You know, we were hanging all the way up above 3%. And mind you, what created a lot of that was the wage inflation we were seeing in the employment reports. We'll see what the employment report maybe says next week, but it did drop the last time we looked at it. And then also stocks, like I mentioned, stocks have their own technicals that they're watching right now. The 200-day moving average for the S&P 500. Since we didn't break it on the last few attempts, like I said, that probably has encouraged some accumulation. So the number of advancing issues on Thursday and Monday definitely tells that story, while treasuries tell a different story. So both eventually will need to communicate the same message. And that typically it may take a little bit of time, but eventually they do. So either treasuries got to give and they got to start falling again and yields got to head up, or stocks need to break down some more.
And next week, we'll probably have some leading economic indicator numbers that may shed some light on the picture. And I'm sure you will be willing to talk about it then. So, Ryan Poplava, have a great weekend.
You too, John. And yeah, like I said, I think the employment data, that'll be a big one to look at. Again, the wage inflation, we saw 2 ticks higher, 1 tick down. What's the trend? That's the big question on my mind.
Should you buy and hold at a market top? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things you love most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk.
Give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. Call toll-free 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
We do our research. It's a combination of macroeconomic top-down analysis of where the world is and also a microeconomic bottom-up. And the fundamentals do apply. And one of the fundamentals is investment demand. And that's probably the most dynamic factor. So we spend a lot of time looking at the global economic outlook and political outlook, and also the stability of the global and regional financial market. And when we go forward, we expect gold and silver prices to rise sharply between now and, say, 2024, probably to record prices by 2022, 2024. For both gold and silver. And the major reason that we say that is that we see investment demand rising, and we see investment demand rising because we see another financial crisis brewing on the horizon.
Well, the stock market, it seemed like it was going to be a good year. A nice strong start in January, but since then, we've had a lot of difficulty. We get a rally, but then we get another correction. We get a rally and another correction. Is something more serious going on? Joining us on the program is Robin Griffith. Robin, let's talk about these corrections. Looks like we're in our third, and we're testing that 200-day moving average. Somebody once told me that the more times you test it, you're more likely to break through it. As you look at this market right now, what is it telling you?
I'm following all world markets. And just to take us back to the start of the year, up until then, the bull market had come up from the 209 low. And we've gone at least 15 months without even a 5% correction. So it was too much of a one-way only bet. The belief had been that the Fed and indeed other central banks would never permit a crash. So there was no downside, and you could sell volatility and just go passively long of the index. And specifically in the case of the USA, the index is weighted by market cap such that a tiny number of stocks called FANGs were able to take the index higher and higher and higher. And they weren't doing it by being cheap, because some of them don't actually pay dividends and have earnings, or if you can calculate a price-earnings ratio, it's in the hundreds and not in old Benjamin Graham-type ranges at all. Now, I think what happened is many cycle theories, including my own, were expecting a setback in late October of last year. There was lots of reasons for expecting that. And it kept a bit of money back just in case. And then they got to the end of the year without any kind of setback at all. They thought, look, okay, we don't want to sit on cash. We better put it into the market. And so the buying power in early January was basically too big for the market to handle. And you got this one-way rush up, which behaved a little bit like a mania, albeit a short-lived one. And then we did begin a correction, which was already overdue. In my terminology, it was actually 3 months late. It was what we were expecting, but it was 3 months late. And chart heuristic rules state that corrections will have a special shape of an initial fall, followed by the rally, followed by the rest of the fall. Some people label it ABC, depending on which type of wave theory, but there's quite a good chance that that will be the shape that it traces out. When we have had the initial fall, from the high. 80% of all world markets were still well above their 200-day moving average. Then when we had the rally, it was even more were above the 200-day moving average. Now that we've dropped back, 60% only are still above their 200-day moving average. So still we can say that where we are now, nearly completing the final leg of the correction phase, still the majority of markets are actually still in a continuing bull market. However, there's an extra signal that technicians use called a golden and a dead cross. So if in a market, the first thing that happens from the high is the index breaks below its own 50-day moving average, then it breaks below its own 200-day moving average, and then finally the 50-day breaks below the 200, that's called a dead cross. That's a continuation, a series of negatively twisted events. And once you've had all of that, there's really a very high probability that you have in fact turned from bull to bear market. Now, of the markets that I'm ranking, the one that did that most clearly was actually Spain. And the other ones where we've got a dead cross in place, the big ones are UK and Germany. So in a nutshell, we can say that the markets that have not only had a correction, but have got an almost confirmed bear market signal are core Europe. In the case of Spain, there's obviously a particular problem to do with Catalonia, but with all of Europe and Brexit, there are these problems. And even before the correction started, these markets were all lagging behind the USA, and they were lagging behind the real markets, which were the top performers, which were all in Asia. It was China, India, and emerging markets. Now, as we look at where we are, the case of the US S&P 500, it nicked below its 200-day moving average and then tried to rally from it. But it's certainly not got a dead cross. When you've only just touched a 200-day line and haven't cut all got the other signals, it's much easier technically for when the correction's over for the subsequent rally to resume a bull market with fewer overhead resistance levels. Whereas in the case of the UK, we've got the 50-day, the 200-day, and the old all-time high, progressive resistance levels above us. It would be much, much harder for core European markets to resume the bull market. However, when you come to the US market, at the general level, it's much easier for it to remain still in a bull market. But the bit that we did forecast, and I think we can say it's happening, some of those FANG stocks, and very particularly Facebook and Tesla, are clearly struggling now. So whereas not all of the FANGs will find that they've got problems, you're going to be finding that it's index investors who, by law, have to over-own these stocks because these are the biggest weights in the index. They're thinking, I'd better diversify some of my risk. I'd better take a bit off these ones and go into something cheaper. And there were a whole lot of stocks which always used to be considered the backbone of the U.S. economy, which are way off their all-time highs. They've actually had bear markets. And although they may not be bargain basement cheap, they're miles better value. They do have earnings and they do pay dividends. And I think people are so far safer in them. So I think within the U.S. market, that you're going to find that rotation from the FANGs, or at least some of them, into stocks like General Electric, IBM, and Walmart, especially now the bad figures are out for Walmart. I mean, okay, in the past, Walmart has suffered at the hands of Amazon, but it's not going to take it lying down. It's going to be saying, okay, if the public want to do this internet shopping, we know we'll put on a team and we'll fight back. So I think if any that type of diversification, you're also getting people saying, well, let's diversify geographically as well. If we under-own markets like in the emerging market and Indian space, we can put more over there. And finally, the big picture is bonds. If you really thought equities were going to a roaring bear market, you'd dump them and you'd buy bonds. However, it seems to be clearer that the economy is sufficiently good for central banks, but particularly the Fed, to keep raising interest rates. And therefore, you know you're going to lose capital value on your bonds, and therefore you're sort of locked into equities. It's Hobson's choice. Now, what's happened in the last month is bonds are cheaper now than they were, and therefore, as a sort of short-term parking place, you actually think, well, at the short month end, I'm not going to lose anything. It's almost cash. I'm okay to hold bonds again. You wouldn't go down the long end so much. One of the things we follow is the spread between twos and tens. If that comes down too narrow to about 50 bits, the message it sends out is you're getting close to an inverted yield curve. And historically, an inverted yield curve has almost always led to a recession about 9 months down the road. That puts you back looking at the state of the economy. Well, the American economy was doing better than the British and European economy anyway. And then Donald has come in with three things, deregulation, infrastructure projects, and tax cuts. I mean, it would be amazing if that combination didn't actually boost the economy a bit. So when the economy has been as good as this in the past, the chance of a recession in the next year has been really very minute. In fact, even in the next 18 months, there's pretty unlikely to be a recession. There would need to be some unforecastable exogenous shock to produce that. One of the potential exogenous shocks was Mr. Kim firing a missile, and we were all very worried about that. But he's willing to talk to the president, and he has talked to China's president, and he's gone to the Olympic Games. So what once seemed like a real threat, it seems we're going to end up with negotiation. And I think with the latest supposed trade war that Mr. Trump seems to be starting with China, it's a form of negotiation. You rattle your saber quite loud, and then you talk to people you're doing business with. So, again, the fear of a trade war, I think, is much more likely to end up with negotiated trade deals. America can sell China some oil or some gas to compensate for, you know, balance things up a bit more. And in any event, with the dollar at the levels that it is, U.S. products are much more competitive than they used to be. It isn't just China keeping their currency down. If that's the name of the game, well, America knows how to play that game, basically. So the economy is in such good nick that for the whole world stock markets to go into a major bear market right now seems rather unlikely. Better than that, very unlikely. If we've got 18 months more to go until we get to a recession, the stock market can anticipate that, usually does. Unfortunately, when you look back to see how much the stock market always, if there isn't an always, if one's anticipated it by 13 months. But if you can say there's an average, it's about two quarters. So if we stay with average figures, on current form for the economy, we won't get a turn down until late 2019. But the period in time in which we should be very worried comes between 2020 and 2023. That is quite likely to be a recession. And if the debt mountain by then, I mean, it's already $21 trillion, it'll be a number that I can't get my head around and is very worried. But I think at the moment what we've got is, in the American markets, and indeed 60% of world markets, we're very near the end of a correction, an overdue correction in a bull market. The bull market's got a bit more time and a bit more upside to go, but the upside will not be as strong and as euphoric as the run-up to January, because the run-up to January was led by the FANG stocks. You only have to push about eight large market cap stocks. Now you're going to have to push up 20 to 30 big but not giant stocks, and their influence on the index is less dramatic. So it'll go higher, but it'll look more like a rolling top. And to break that, you'd need an exogenous shock, which I can't predict. Whereas when you come to core Europe, they've already in a bear market.
Robin, let me talk about something that we're seeing in this kind of third corrective phase that we didn't see in the previous two, and that is the breakout of what we would consider risk-off type of stocks. We're seeing utilities break out. We're seeing healthcare, consumer staples are breaking out, and we've seen a bit of a rally in bonds. Does that tell you that the market is transitioning to this final phase that you see?
Yes, I think it's exactly what it does show us. They've decided that they run with a few big bets long enough, in fact, over long. They've been lucky. And you don't want to just sit on cash because you don't really make a living doing that. But you want to diversify across asset classes into traditional so-called higher quality ones, especially as the VIX things that always used to be normal, having had a few years in a period of super subnormal volatility. So we're going to live in a slightly more dangerous, more volatile world. So you want to go for quality, you want to go for more value, unless you're not trying to shoot the lights out, you're trying to survive in a difficult period. I think this is it. We know we're late cycle. We're almost very late cycle. But I was misquoting Winston Churchill, you know, that one, this is not the end, or even the beginning of the end, but we're well past the end of the beginning. That's where we are. We know we're late cycle, but the economy is in sufficiently good shape globally as well. It isn't. I mean, even in the UK, our economy is actually growing. It's just growing slower than other people's. And in the Asian economies, I mean, for example, my long-term favorite, India, was growing at 6.5%. It now looks like it's nearer 7.5%. So I think exactly what you've been pointing out is investors trying to diversify away from a too focused, fang-only portfolio to something that spreads risks more widely and tries to buy better value. And that we will survive. I think that's the answer.
Robin, what about the concept everybody expects in the late phase of a business cycle with increased fiscal spending coming and stimulus that we're going to be in a more inflationary environment from a disinflationary? In other words, inflation is increasing. So if you look at commodities like gold, you look at commodities like oil, the commodities are doing well, Robin, but ever since that January correction, the stocks have not confirmed the commodities. If you look at GDX, it's not confirming gold. If you look at the XLE, it's not confirming oil. What is that telling you?
Yeah, I think you're right. In my work, for many, a long time, the commodity index was right at the bottom of the ranking order. You didn't want to own it. But particularly precious and industrial metals, those metals that have to do with electric cars, which is copper, or batteries, lithium, and the metals that go in the batteries, which these days is nickel as well as cadmium, they clearly were a bit special. I think in the case of oil, it is a bit special in the sense that with the Arab nation trying to sell the crown jewels because they know that we're sort of near the end of the oil era, the price was puffed up so that they could get the stock away. Really, I mean, we're still going to be burning oil 50 years from now. So when the coal era ended, the world didn't stop burning coal. Now that the oil era is ending, we're not going to stop burning oil. But we're moving on to something better and cleaner, and it's basically electric. So copper wires are on a roll. There are very short-term technical reasons why the price of copper could slip back a bit. But in my language, it's in a secular uptrend. I'm going to buy every dip on copper for quite a long time because an electric motor is copper wiring. That's what it is. We're going to be using a lot, lot more of it. I'm not an expert on the softs, the foods, but just looking at some charts, they seem to have turned up now. And that must be to America's advantage because America produces far more of these things and can export them all around the world. And therefore, if there's going to be a bit of an argument with, say, China, it's going to be on, well, if you want to buy our pigs, we're going to charge you more money for it. It's part of the negotiated package of the so-called trade war. But basically, in an inflationary environment, you'd expect commodities to go higher. I am personally long of an ETF on gold bullion. But I'm not excited about it at the moment because I've been watching it fluctuate between about 1,200 and 1,360 several times in the past. On my chart, it is still in a long-term secular uptrend, but it won't get exciting again unless it can actually break above $1,383 an ounce. I'm expecting it to do that, but until it does it, I don't go overboard on it, really. Silver has actually been a little more exciting, but I think the trouble with gold is the paper gold market is bigger than the real gold market. And we do know that certain authorities regularly trade in the paper gold market as a way of sort of manipulating expectations in the market. And I think at the moment what they've got, they've manipulated us and the public into thinking that the economy is in good shape. Wage rises are probably where force on inflation is going to come through. We can, under these circumstances, hike interest rates from negative territory to real territory while the going is good. and we'd better get on with this, because otherwise when the economy turns down again, we won't have any scope to help out. We'll have got no bullets in the gun, as it were. So I think the market expects at least three more hikes, albeit small ones, this year. And certainly the 10-year getting up to 3.5%, going on 4%, is probably in market expectations. Any idea that it goes more than that, though, I think you would have a relative panic in the market. The other thing I have noticed is some of the really big institutions are sitting on as much cash and near cash as their mandate allows them to do. They're already there. And you don't tend to start a bear market from everybody's already in cash. You have to get them to put that cash into the market, and then you can start a bear market. So in my mind, for 60% of world markets, but especially including the USA, this shakeout will end. You won't get a dead cross. And then onto those bigger, more basic companies, the backbone of America, they will go higher, and the market will go up and probably make a new high, not miles higher than it's been before, but definitely higher. And we've got probably another 9 months at least in it before you want to go totally whisk off.
Well, listen, Robin, as our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
I write two newsletters. One is available called Global Investment Roadmap, and you go to the website and it tells you .com how to get that. That one is really written for institutional investors. I'm going to have a new one coming out with the Agora Press, which is, of course, Bill Bonner's American. So that one you'll hear about much more easily. And that's part of the Agora group and will be called Dynamic Trend Alert. But the first one is coming out in April, so we're nearly there. So look forward to that. That would be the best way to get it.
Well, when that comes out, I'll have to have you back and we'll talk about it. Robin, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program, and you have yourself a great Easter weekend.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Interest rates are rising, and the Fed intends to raise interest rates even further. As rates rise, the value of your bond funds will fall. Are you prepared for the next bond bear market? It has been almost 36 years since we've seen the last, and there's a high probability that another bear market in bonds has just begun. Long-term interest rates have been rising steadily since last fall. It's time to think about protecting capital. That's where Financial Sense Advisors can help you. Protect capital by designing a customized portfolio that can provide you with predictable income. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Call us today.
So give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. As investment fiduciaries, we put your interest first. Let us help you design a portfolio that provides predictable income and protects your capital. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939 to let us help you design a portfolio providing predictable income and protecting your capital. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Michael Robinson from the Blueprint Insurance Services. Michael, I wonder if we might begin for our listeners, describe the different kind of annuities out there. There's variable annuities, there's index annuities, there's immediate annuities. Let's define what kind of annuities are out there, and then let's talk about when they're appropriate to use, where they fit in retirement planning, in the things that you should be looking at. Are they good? They're bad? When they're appropriate. So let's begin with the type of annuities.
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it. The different types of annuities that are out there today are single premium immediate annuities that are known as SPIAs. There are pure fixed annuities. There are multi-year guaranteed annuities. There's index annuities, and there are also variable annuities. So those are the different types of annuities that are in the marketplace today.
We'll be right back. Well, the price of gold has been struggling three times this year. We've tried to take out the 1360 level, but every time we got up there, we have pulled back. Joining us on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. Dave, I want to begin our discussion and not just talk about the metal itself, but I want to talk about the price of a commodity compared to its stock. And if you take a look at, for example, the price of gold and then the, let's say, a gold index like GDX, the two were basically following each other until we got to that first correction in January. And we've had various people comment on it. Since that time, the metals have outperformed the stocks, and it's not just what I find fascinating. It's not just what's going on in the gold market, but it's also going on in the energy market. So I would like to get your perspective, the lag of the stocks compared to the metal, because certainly we saw that in the past, in the run-up to 2008, towards the very end, the commodity was outperforming the stock. So were the stocks giving us, let's say, an advance notice that it was coming to an end? So your thoughts, if you would.
Certainly. First of all, the fact is that gold itself is the most negatively correlated asset to the stock market. And that's gold, not gold stocks. In a bull market, normally gold stocks will lead, which means, of course, that they're performing as well as gold or better than gold. And as you just stated, that is not the case. So at this juncture, I am still long-term bullish, but I'm hesitant to state that, happy days are here again, especially for the mining equities that one of our specialties, what we spend most of our focus on. So there is a signal there. How to interpret it, I'm not exactly certain. But I am cautious here. So we're still building cash, Jim, and looking for assets that are very much underrated or underperforming that we think have, great value. But I'm cautious.
Yeah, because usually when you see something like a large divergence, one of those two stories is going to be right. Either the price of the commodity has it right or the price of the stocks have it right. And what I find fascinating is if you were just to look at this one commodity, call it gold, and what's going on with the stocks, you would say, okay, well, there's something going on there. But when you see the same thing being repeated with the price of oil, because the price of oil right now is close to $65 a barrel, it's higher than most people thought it would be. But the stocks, as oil has climbed back up towards that $65 level, the stocks have really not confirmed it. So it's rather interesting. So let's talk about the price of gold in this kind of market. Everybody believes we're coming towards the end of a business cycle. We have a tremendous amount of stimulus that's being applied to the economy with tax cuts, and now government is spending money like drunken sailors, and the deficits are being blown out. This year, they could be anywhere from $700 to $800 billion, Dave. Next year, CBO is talking about a $1 trillion deficit, and we're not even in a recession. I wonder if you might share with our listeners your thoughts on the correlation of gold to U.S. rising deficits.
Well, there's a chart that's used by many of us that has to do with the gold debt laid on top of each other. So if you look at the U.S. debt versus gold from the inception of the bull market in 2000, the upward trend for debt increasing is matched almost perfectly by the gold price. And after the 2008 financial crisis, it dipped down and then it accelerated up from the 2008 bottom all the way up to 1900 in 2011. And if you look at that curve, it overshot the increase in debt substantially at that point in time. After that, there's been this correction, and it actually crossed over in about 2014. And since that time until now, gold, as we know, has basically traced out a large pattern between about 1400 and 1100. And it is now well under the debt increase that we've seen from 2011 onward. And if you match it to this parameter, what you'll find is that gold would have to recover to about $1,900 an ounce to match the increase in debt over these last 5 years. So gold, again, you did trigger a thought about, my previous comment. If gold is the most negatively correlated asset and it's doing fairly well, and the stock market is starting a major correction, which I think is the case, then gold would continue to do fairly well here as this correction in the overall equity market takes place over the next months and perhaps years. And gold stocks are stocks, so they usually correlate better with the overall stock market, at least initially. You can look at 2008 to see that. And what does happen, or happened last time and is likely to happen this next time, is once the shift in asset classes takes place and gold becomes kind of the shining star again, then you could see a big catch-up move in the gold stocks. But I'm patient. I want to see that performance take place before I get, let's say, more committed than I am at this point in time.
You know, one of the surprising aspects about this, let's say, economic recovery in bull market in stocks, Dave, is when the Fed started QE, the gold stocks and gold began a rise coming out of 2009 all the way to a peak in 2011. The Fed eventually ended QE around 2014 as they began to unwind with the taper. A lot of people thought with all of this excess money that was being created, that it would create an inflationary rise, which we did not see, other than the fact that the inflation took place in assets. So, you know, the stock market is up 3 or 4 fold since that period of time. This time around, and especially after 2011, the money went more towards stocks, whether it was stocks in general, like the S&P, or more recently, over the last year and a half, the FANG stocks like Amazon, Facebook, and Google, and some of the big tech name stocks. Why do you think gold did not participate, or why we did not get the inflationary increase other than assets with all of this money printing that we've seen globally, not just here, but in Europe and Japan and around the globe?
Well, that goes back to the curve I hopefully described fairly well. So we saw an acceleration in the gold price after the 2008 financial crisis. And I think at that point in time, Jim, gold anticipated that it would be the leader due to inflationary pressures. So again, it got to 1900. But what happened is exactly what you just stated, that the assets that went up and up and up was the general equity market. So gold saw that, the reality of that. And the reason being is because the assets went into the banking sector that gets used the printed new money first, and it went into the equity market. And gold became, over especially the last several years, less and less of an asset class that anyone anywhere, managed money on down to retail investors, wanted anything to do with. So the same thing happened in silver, in fact, to a larger degree, because most people after the crisis thought that this massive amount of money that was being printed to make the banking sector solvent again was going to show up as inflationary pressure. It did not. It only went in the banking system. It didn't go on the main street. So there was no real inflation that people could see, you know, by increasing food prices, energy prices, et cetera. And that meant that there had to be something else to put your money into. And that became, of course, the equity markets.
So let's talk about going forward. As we just began our conversation, we know that the deficits are going to start to increase. And Dave, you know, if we're talking about $700 to $800 billion this year, $1 trillion next year, we're not even talking about a recession yet, because we know in a recession, two things happen. Government expenses go up with unemployment, Medicaid, Medicare, all those expenses that are coming forward with baby boomers retiring. And during a recession, the government takes in less tax revenues. They take in less from individuals as they lose their job and the unemployment rate goes up and corporate profits go down. So if we're heading for $1 trillion deficits now in an economy that's growing, what happens to these numbers when we start seeing maybe $1.5 trillion and possibly $2 trillion if this economy goes hard into a recession? What does gold do in that kind of environment?
Well, at the risk of sounding a bit corny, there is going to be a point where you will see inflation come back. And I think that's what gold's waiting for. Now, gold is a crisis hedge. It doesn't necessarily need inflation, but everyone in the modern era believes that gold and silver are inflation hedges. The lid can't be put on this money printing forever. And I think once the general public, and again, even the money managers, the sector of institutions come back in the gold market, you'll see an acceleration. And I think it'll be hard to stop this next time. But again, I think gold is biding its time. You could look at the argument the reverse, which means that if gold's negatively correlated and the stock market has made these phenomenal new highs for the last few years, then gold actually has done fairly well, meaning that it's been in this broad trading range that I outlined and hasn't like seeked out new lows. So there's still some amount of gold that is coveted by major nation states such as Russia and China primarily that understand the long-term benefits of having fiscal responsibility. And that, I think, has kept the gold price in this range. So I think it's waiting, as you say, for a catalyst, and I think it's going to take place. And I think you'll see it basically understood by most of the more awake people and institutions by the end of this year.
So looking forward, as you said, you've been somewhat of a on the cautious side, looking for some kind of catalyst or stimulus. If you were looking forward and you were looking at anything that would be a catalyst to the price of precious metals, what do you think that would be at this point?
Well, I think it'll be when we accept the fact that we're in a recessionary environment and that there's noticeable inflation for the average person out there, meaning, you know, food prices are starting to be noticeably higher and higher, perhaps energy prices as well. Rents aren't coming down. And even though we're in a recession, the expectation, of course, is that prices come down in recession. But in a stagflation, you can see increasing prices and higher unemployment. So I think that's the scenario that we're going to be seeing. And I, again, that I think will be the catalyst that people that have money to save, and a lot of middle America has basically been wiped out. They don't have any savings anymore, but there still is a lot of money sloshing around in the markets, and they'll be seeking what is the best place to park that money. And that will probably come back to the precious metals.
All right, let me throw another idea out there that has surfaced, and you see this repeatedly in the financial media when they talk about gold, and that is the competition that's coming in from cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. I know you and I have talked about that, but several experts have said that, you know, one reason gold is not doing well, it has competition with cryptocurrencies. Do you buy into that argument?
Somewhat. There's anecdotal evidence. I don't have enough empirical data to say this is it. Especially on the silver side. I mean, silver investors have a different mentality than most gold investors, and they're more short term and higher risk. They'll take a higher beta. So I've got more evidence on the silver side, but it applies to gold as well, that, and it's mostly the millennials are looking at gold as passe, moving out of that sector and moving into the cryptocurrencies. How much of an effect it's had, I think that's overblown, but it certainly has had some effect. I do think that there's going to be a consolidation in the cryptos. And what's interesting is now I think the next leg up in the cryptos is getting set, but a lot of it will be based on a merger between physical metals and cryptocurrencies. There are several gold-backed cryptos that are coming to the fore, as well as silver-backed cryptocurrencies. The problem with a lot of these cryptocurrencies is most of them are trash, meaning there really isn't anything behind them other than a white paper and a bunch of hype. And the market's understood that at this point in time, and it's fallen off substantially. So again, I think the next catalyst up could be an association with something that's, you know, proven to be money for thousands of years. So I'm looking at that carefully. I don't want to overextend my thought there. I want the market to tell me more than I tell it. But certainly that is taking place as we speak.
Yeah, the one thing that struck me about this is, Dave, when we saw the ETF GLD come into competition with the gold stocks, and, you know, previous to that, if you wanted to own gold, you had to go in the futures market or you had to walk into a coin shop. And most people simply don't want it or are knowledgeable enough to play the futures market because of the leverage involved. And secondly, you know, most people don't think of going into a coin shop picking up coins. But when you can go on your laptop, type in three syllables, GLD, and press a button and you own gold, it made it much easier. So the commodity ETFs came in and competed and gave competition to the gold stocks themselves, because before you were more likely to buy a gold stock because it was easy and it was something you knew how to do. Going into the futures market and going into a coin shop requires a special kind of knowledge.
Well said, Jim. Exactly right. And it also applied mostly to the institutional side, because any equity fund manager cannot buy a commodity, but when it's a stock, they can. And that's what I think the main purpose was, is you made a commodity, gold and silver, the SLV and the GLD, a commodity that could be traded as an equity. And this had a huge influence on the price and the trading versus the gold stock. So well said, and it's something that some people may have forgotten about, but it's very, very important.
Let's talk about something else in the commodities area. In at one time, at least if we went back to the last decade, Dave, uranium was a hot commodity, especially with nuclear power. Then, of course, we had Fukushima that kind of threw uranium off. And then there was also rare earths, which are used in so much of technology today. Any follow-up? I know at one time you were looking at those areas. Any comments on uranium or, let's say, rare earth minerals? I mean, which, you know, one time these were the kind of hot stocks if you looked in the last decade when we had that run up in gold and other commodities.
Well, the Morgan Report does look at all the resources across the board. I'm still pretty bearish on uranium. I mean, there's a couple of companies out there we like and we're still holding, but overall, I think we've got at least a 2 to 3 year wait on uranium. As far as the rare earths, it got way overdone. I remember speaking at a conference years ago and saying it was overdone and should take some profit. And I got a bit of argument from the floor. In other words, the people listening to my speech, and that's fine. I was early. I was probably a year early, Jim. But had you taken my advice and cashed out at that point in time, you'd be loving me now because of how much most of these have fallen off or gone away. I did speak, coincidentally, with somebody that's very well known in the REE space, and China's basically tied it up, as we all know, but it's not as, let's say, as tight a market, or it's been overhyped. So the amount of rare earths that are required is certainly there. China still is the lead there, but the market's basically starting to reach equilibrium at this point in time. And again, it isn't a place that I'm willing to put any cash into at this point. I think it's another wait and see.
A final question, which I find a little bit humorous. You and I were talking a while back about what happened to a lot of junior mining companies in the downturn with gold over the last 3 or 4 years. You know, it was the junior mining companies that were doing the exploration work, and they did very well in the run-up of gold up to 1900. But in the downturn, a lot of these companies went out of business. And I think, Dave, I believe it was you that was telling me that some of these silver companies, that pure silver, they never got the volumes that would make them, let's say, a permanent fixture in the metals market, but they've turned actually to growing marijuana as a way of making money. Is that still the case?
You know, it is. I mean, the marijuana sector has been huge, especially in Canada, and it continues. So, yeah, I wrote an article. I have to make a joke. I'm not the most humorous guy in the world, but I wrote an article for the public domain saying, you know, the miners have gone to pot. They did. And a lot of them are still there. So this marijuana, a lot of these junior miners or junior microcap stocks that are primarily out of Vancouver and the Vancouver Stock Exchange, a lot of these types are looking for the next big thing, and they don't care if it's mining or marijuana or rare earths or whatever it is. These guys are willing to, you know, get a small microcap company or buy a shell or whatever and promote the heck out of it. So you got to be very careful in that sector, especially when you look at the junior space. And that's why when I started the Morgan Report, I did it more from an institutional side, meaning, you know, top quality stocks like Franco-Nevada and Wheaton Precious Metals and Royal Gold and those types of stocks where we put big money, write options against the position and continue to do well because those are special cases that make money regardless of the price of gold. And then we moved into the producers, which is our mid-tier, and we're very careful in the speculative sector because that's the hardest to analyze and the hardest to ferret out the wheat from the chaff.
Well said, because a lot of these guys are simply promoters, and it doesn't matter whether it's silver, it could be gold, or the case now, it's marijuana, and who knows what it'll be in the future. Dave, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the Morgan Report, tell them how they could do so, please.
Jim, if you don't mind, I just want to make one case because I owe it to your listeners, and that is the Commitment of Traders report that's been out on the internet from everybody from the Silver Doctors to myself. And before I do, I'm going to read this real brief alert that came out of Bloomberg this morning. This is by Eddie van der Walt, Bloomberg. For the macro investor, silver is an increasingly tarnished asset. less liquid than gold. Its performance as a haven is mediocre, and its industrial heyday is far behind it. The demise of film photography, followed by a thrifting in the solar panel industry, means demand for silver has steadily declined. Meanwhile, supply has proven sticky because it's produced as a byproduct of other metals like copper and gold. In all, the fundamentals are grim, with the world producing more silver than it consumes for 4 years straight, according to Metals Focus. Its correlation to gold remains extremely strong, near 0.9, measured over the last 30 days. But the former is heading for a third consecutive quarterly gain, while silver is down 4% last year. The price ratio is the highest in nearly 2 years. These days, silver looks like a very high beta inflation hedge with an exaggerated downside risk. So now, the commitment of traders is the best setup I've seen probably in 20 years, which means that the non-commercials or the trading funds are short 13,000 contracts. That's a huge number for them. And the commercials, which are habitually massively short, are short, basically they're flat. They're short 87,000 contracts and long 84,000 for a net, let's say 3,000 contracts net short, which is the smallest number I've ever seen. The problem, Jim, is one of my favorite quotes. When everyone's thinking the same, no one's thinking very much. From that commitment of traders looking at the positioning, it's a screaming buy to go long silver. However, what concerns me is the fact that no one talks about the open interest. And the open interest in silver is about 217,000 contracts, which when I traded basis the COT, and I still look at it, the way I knew to go long was that the setup that I just described looked very good, and the open interest had fallen to a certain level. In fact, in the early days, you could almost count on it being at an exact level of open interest, and from that point, you know the market was going to go higher. That's not the case now. So I, again, remain cautious. I want to wait and see what the market is going to do. I do have a long position that's going to be triggered by the market itself, not by what I think the silver price is going to do. So I think coming back to what you asked, so the best thing to do is to get to themorganreport.com. Just get on our free service for our free newsletter. I do a weekly update that covers all the financial markets and always close out with the comments on the gold and silver price.
It has been 10 years this month that a financial crisis engulfed the United States and the global financial system, almost bringing the whole world system to the brink of collapse, and only Herculean efforts by the Fed and central banks pulled it back from the precipice. And now it looks like, off in the distance, there may be storm clouds forming of another recession or even a depression. So if that's so, what are the indicators and what should we be doing? That's coming up next on The Big Picture. And also, Chris Sheridan welcomes Bruce Schneier. He's Chief Technology Officer at Resilient Systems and author of Data and Goliath, The Hidden Battles to Collect Your Data and Control Your World. All of that on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at FinancialSense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.